is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
It's 106. Why do prescription drugs cost so much? That's the question we take up in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. You're tuned to WILL AM 580. Our guest this afternoon is award-winning journalist Meryl Guzner, a former chief economics correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Guzner is the author of The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs. In this book, Meryl Guzner reports that American taxpayers are picking up the tab for research on diseases and medicines, and taxpayers, he says, are taking a double hit. We underwrite the research done at universities and at the National Institutes of Health, and then, as consumers, we pay again. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. I look forward to your telephone calls. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest, Meryl Guzner. He is a contributing editor for The American Prospect. His work has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Columbia Journalism Review, and online at Slate.com and Salon.com. He recently joined the Center for Science in the Public Interest to direct its Integrity in Science project. The $800 million pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs, is published by the University of California Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Meryl Guzner, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Glad to be with you, Celeste.
The figure you've used for the title of the book, $800 million, that's a figure the pharmaceutical industry has placed on discovering a new drug. Where does that number come from, and does it really cost $800 million to develop a new drug?
Well, the number is comes from a study that was done at Tufts University, paid for by the pharmaceutical industry. And what they did was is that they went through they did a survey essentially of some pharmaceutical companies' new drug offerings, including their failures, and then came up with a cost. Which they went through a lot of economic tinkering with. They capitalized it, meaning like they took account for the time value of money and divided it by the number of drugs that actually got approved by the FDA, the group that they studied, and they came up with this overall number. Part of the book, I try to poke holes in the number, but I think the title of the book is really try to call attention to the idea that there is this vast expenditure in research and development that drug companies make that they claim is the justification for why drug prices have to be so high. And they take that argument one step further and say, unless drug prices stay so high, and if you do anything to lower those prices, whether it be going to Canada or the government negotiating a lower price for drugs, then innovation will dry up. There will be no more new drugs coming out of the industrial pipeline. And it is that argument, really, that my book was designed to take on by looking at answering really two basic questions. Where do new drugs really come from? Where does medical innovation come from? And then once one has an idea for something innovative, what in the real world did it cost to actually develop that idea? And I developed those themes in the book by looking at a number of what I consider to be the more significant medical innovations of the last quarter of the 20th century, and follow them one by one within the book.
Yeah. In the book, you say the industry is essentially saying, if we don't get your money to spend on research and development, you'll die. That's how you put it. And this, you say, is taking a corporate model of research and development as key to survival and turning it upside down. How was the industry able to transform that model of research and development as key to survival, as key to being able to compete in the marketplace, and transform it so radically?
Well, that's you're touching on an interesting thing that got me interested in this subject, which is that I have been covering, before I became a skilled science reporter in the course of doing the research for this book, I actually spent most of my career as a business reporter. And in covering business, I'd gone to numbers of annual meetings and interviewed chief executive officers and people involved with company innovation. And the mantra that you always heard from companies, and this is in a wide variety of industries, is that we have to invest in research and development. If we don't do that, we won't keep up with the competition, our product mix will get old, and therefore it's incumbent on us to do that, and these are in very important expenditures. And in fact, the tax code and SEC accounting regulations treat it that way. They allow businesses to deduct research and development from their corporate bottom lines, dollar for dollar. So in other words, it's an expense, just like paying labor is an expense. It was only when I first began reporting on the drug industry, and it was in the context of the Medicare debate in Washington, this was in the late 1990s, the first time that I really got heavily involved in reporting that subject, and the pharmaceutical industry's representatives would appear on Capitol Hill and in other places in the media, and they would say, unless we get high prices, we won't innovate. And I literally, it was one of those cognitive dissonant moments that sometimes happens to reporters. You say, you know, I've been listening to corporate CEOs my entire adult life as a reporter, and I've never heard this argument before. Every other company says they have to invest in R&D. They're telling us that if we don't get the high, in order to keep our revenue coming in, they're telling us is that if we don't give them the revenue, they won't innovate. It was just backwards. And it really just put the questions in my own mind, really, where does innovation in medicine actually come from? Is it coming from the pharmaceutical industry, or is there another story there?
Yeah, and I want to get to that story and the story of the passionate investigators and basic science. But before we enter into that story, let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us in Normal on line 4. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I would like to know, is there a specific law that was passed that allows pharmaceuticals to get away with charging us more than foreigners? And would this be, could we hold the congressman that voted for it to account in the next election?
There now is a law. And it was part of the drug bill that was passed late last year, the Medicare Prescription Drug Act, that specifically prohibits the government, the federal government, from negotiating lower prices. There is no law that says that we have to pay higher prices than, say, Canada. But the fact of the matter is that Canada, like most of the advanced industrial world, has national health care systems that negotiate prices as a single buyer. And so as a result, you have what in essence is what the economists call a monopsonist buyer. A monopsonist is the opposite of a monopolist. It's when there's only one buyer. A monopolist means there's only one supplier. Well, in the economics literature, you have what's called monopsony. And when you have a national healthcare system that acts as the buyer of drugs in the marketplace, they have market power. They can determine, you know, if you don't give me a decent price for your drug, I happen to know that this drug over here is comparable in medical value, so I'll go to that company. And they actually have some power in the marketplace then, and they can negotiate what they consider to be a fair price for the drug. It's only America where we have a multiplicity of buyers, where that buying power is severely weakened. And in the new Medicare drug law, they actually prohibited the government, once it gets in the business of buying drugs for senior citizens, from engaging in using collective purchasing power of senior citizens to get a better deal for the price of drugs. A real unfortunate side effect of what in many other ways was also a fairly bad law, in my opinion.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other Questions are invited. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Meryl Guzner, author of The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs. A couple of basic questions here I think we should get out on the table. Collectively, what are we spending on prescription drugs annually in the U.S.?
Well, there's a lot of different numbers thrown around, and it's hard to pin down a single number. The latest estimate I saw is about $160 billion a year. It's about somewhere in the range of 3% of GDP. Another way to look at that is the percentage of total health care spending, which is now about 15% of GDP. Drugs used to be a fairly small part of health expenditures, and they remain a small fraction of overall health care expenditures. But it's growing, and it's the fastest growing part. And that's probably the reason why it gets so much attention.
And what's the industry's profit margin?
Well, again, this can vary from year to year. Perhaps one of the better surveys that people look at is the Fortune magazine listing of the top 500 corporations. They rank industries by profit margins. And year after year, the pharmaceutical industry ranks right at the top of all industries in the United States. Generally speaking, it's somewhere between 25 and 30% of gross sales falls to the bottom line as profit, which is significantly higher than most other industries.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener, caller on a cell phone on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Yes. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
I agree with you that the price of prescription medicines, especially the patent medicines, are extremely high, the highest in the world, although I think a capitalistic point of view with concerning prices and that is that the market, to whatever the market will bear, and obviously the United States has a high bearable market here for prescription medicines, but then look at it for a couple different other standpoints. Half of the medicines that are given out today are generic, and without a brand name, you would not have generic. In addition to that, I know medicines are quite a hot topic, and justifiably so, I understand, but at the same time that the real cost of medicine that people are really shocked about, perception is that 50% of medical cost is prescription medicines, which is not correct. It's about 15%. And the 30%, which is bureaucracy, is something that really, and I was listening to one of the speakers about a year ago that mentioned that instead of 31 cents on the dollar for bureaucracy in the United States, in Europe, it's closer to 7%. And I think that there's the aspect of medicine and its value to the patient is not brought out very often, but you can do a lot of labs and a lot of the CAT scans, x-rays, and you can do many different things for a diagnosis. But if you don't have the medicine, a lot of patients won't even go to the doctor because they wouldn't want the extra expense when they couldn't really have anything resolved. Now, that doesn't excuse the high prices, but I think if you look at it from a different standpoint, you might think that these are things that are really improving longevity of life as opposed to things that are just causing more hectic complications of the bureaucracy. And I'll let you respond to that. Thank you.
Well, there wasn't exactly a question there, but you raise a couple of points that I think are worth highlighting in light of the research in my book. First off is that people go to the doctors and they get a battery of tests and they have to give them something. It's sort of like people are looking for some kind of pill or medicine that will cure the particular disease they have. And in fact, there is a tremendous amount of improper prescribing that goes on, particularly for senior citizens. And the actual efficaciousness of the medicines, not to mention the possible health problems that comes from improper prescribing, especially when you see some senior citizens taking 5, 6, 7, and 8 medicines, so you get these drug interactions. These problems are well documented in the medical literature, both the extent of improper prescribing and the possible problems that come from it. So that, you know, the issue that the caller raises is the one of the sort of, I don't know if fat is the right word, but just the way our medical system operates has a tendency to sort of multiply costs. He also raised the issue of administrative overhead, which I don't know that that's a subject for me. Again, it's been addressed much better by others. It's absolutely true that we have the highest administrative costs in the world and helps contribute to the fact that we have the highest health care costs in the world, which gets back to one of the issues I was talking about earlier, which is that when you don't have, when you have multiple insurance companies, multiple payer systems, you inevitably have duplication in the bureaucracy that goes along with medicine. Again, while the subjects that he's raising are not directly apropos the subject of my book, they're very important in thinking about the rising cost of both healthcare and in general, and medicine in particular.
Let's talk with another caller, listener in Savoy on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello. I had heard where pharmaceutical companies use a vast majority of their research dollars to basically copy other drugs. Viagra is a perfect example of this, where it's the hottest thing out there, so the other companies who aren't in on the patent that Viagra has, they take Viagra, study it, and try to copy it and reap the immediate profits by, you know, coming out with a very, very similar drug. Is there any basis for that that you found?
I want to thank the caller for that question. It's actually a major focus of one of the chapters of my book. They're called Me Too drugs, and they're as old as the drug industry itself. The reality is that when basic science learns how to intervene in a medical problem, and when either sometimes it's a university researcher, sometimes it's a, it has been industry researchers, but whenever we come up with a way of intervening with that, a chemical, a drug, an antibiotic, whatever it might be, and it's brand new, and it's a real major breakthrough, and humankind has advanced as a result, in that we now know how to fight a disease. But then you have a dozen drug companies out there, and they all look at that and they say, ah, me too. And they want to compete for that marketplace. So their chemists go to work, take a look at what the chemical was that was successful, and they come up with permutations of that. Now, in the best of all possible worlds, that would result in competition in price between competitors for what's obviously similar treatments for similar maladies. But that never happens. And there's actually a very good discussion in the economic literature about why it happens. It has to do with the interaction of our patent system, which all of these become patented medicines, and so there is no incentive for them to compete on price. Going back even 40 years ago now, the late Senator Estes Kefauver of Tennessee instigated hearings into what he called the antibiotic cartel, which was the operation of drug companies, in this case in the 1950s, all of whom came up with Me Too antibiotics that competed in the marketplace without ever competing on price. And so this is an old, old story that continues to play out. You asked about how much of industry research and development is devoted to Me Too drugs. Well, they come in a variety of ways. Let me talk about another way very briefly, and then I'll answer that question. It's not just looking at some other company's drug and saying, I want one just like theirs. What happens when you get to the end of your patent life on a drug, which is used to be 17 years, now it's 20 years, but what happens when you get to the end of your patent life and all of a sudden you're going to face generic competition? Not only that, generics are going to take over your market at a much lower price. Well, you now have an incentive to maintain that very high cash flow from the patent medicine by coming up with a drug that is just like the other one, but if you're lucky, slightly better. But is it possible to come up with something that's even just a mild variation of it and then patent that, get another 17 years of exclusivity, and then market that as quote-unquote new and improved, even if the medical literature would tell you that there's not really that much improvement, if any at all, in this drug? And that is where a substantial amount of research and development today is going into, is coming up for new drugs that are really mechanisms for extending the patent life and the cash flow from a tried-and-true therapy that would that will go generic. And I can give you some, you know, Nexium for Prilosec, you know, is a classic example of this. And, in fact, Nexium is contained within Prilosec, and that's an interesting story. So I try in the book to make an estimate for how much of industry R&D goes into this kind of behavior, and I would estimate that it's at least half. And again, one of the ironies, it's one of the things we say, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But at those late 1950, early 1960 hearings that Estes Kefauver held, he asked an industry representative from the Research and Development Department of one of the, I think it was Squibb, E.J. Squibb, which is now gone and has been taken over by other companies. But he asked him, what, you know, when you look for drugs that are really have no medical utility, but really to enhance your bottom line and to come up with drugs that really just replicate the action of drugs that are already on the market, what percent of your R&D goes to that? He says, oh, I would estimate it's about half.
Does a listener want to follow up?
No, thanks.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Meryl Guzner is our guest this afternoon. He's a journalist, the author of The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs. Another listener waiting to talk with us, Champagne, line two. Hi.
Yeah, we all contribute to the research that the NIH and our universities do. Can you tell us more about how it is the pharmaceuticals can capitalize on that and thereby save themselves millions and millions? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Yeah, you know, it's really a complicated process, and it's hard to distill down simply. But to understand research and development in medicine, you have to begin with basic science. What causes a disease? And virtually all of the money that gets spent on basic research in understanding disease, which is the foundation of what you need in order to come up with a therapeutic approach to curing disease. So all of that research is basically done in the public sector. To the extent it's not done by the government directly, and it's not just NIH, there's actually other budgets hidden away. Like, for instance, Walter Reed in the Department of Defense does a tremendous amount of medical research. There's even a congressionally mandated research programs in things like breast cancer and prostate cancer, also in the Department of Defense. So sprinkled throughout the federal budget, there is health-related expenditures that if you totaled the whole thing up, would be probably about 90-95% of what industry spends on research and development every year. In addition to what the government spends, there's also a large number of philanthropic, large fortunes, essentially, that were devoted to medical research. Probably some of the more famous ones are like the Mayo Clinic up in Minnesota. You also have Howard Hughes left his fortune to medical research and now spends something like $500 million a year on, you know, various levels of medical research, and there's a number of those kinds of foundations around the country. Now, that said, in order to come up with therapeutics, to take basic knowledge, you have to discover something about how a disease gets caused or works. Now, that's where one of the things that I point out in the book, or at least the anecdotes that I recount in the book show is that when you really get right down to it, innovation in pharmaceuticals is kind of rare. It's not every day that there was an interesting article on the front page of the New York Times yesterday talking about Alzheimer's drugs, and there's a couple of them out there, and it turns out they're not very effective. Well, why is that? It's simply because we really don't understand what causes the disease yet. And if you don't understand what causes the disease, then drugs that you come up with to treat disease are really, it's almost, it would be a stroke of blind luck to have one that was like the equivalent of an antibiotic. You know that if you have a bug and you treat it with an antibiotic, presuming it's not antibiotic-resistant bug, that you're going to get the bug. You're going to kill it. And that's because we understand the bug and we understand what the drug does to it. But for a lot of degenerative diseases, especially of aging, and of course the great example of all of this is cancer. And when we say cancer, we're not talking about one disease. We're talking about more than 100 diseases. But when you talk about cancer, we have spent in the government sector alone more than $50 billion since President Richard Nixon declared war on, and Congress appropriated money for a war on cancer in 1971. And in fact, the National Cancer Institute goes back to the middle 30s, so there's been more than money than that even spent. But our understanding of, we look at cancer rates and we look at cancer cure rates, and while there's some improvement, we still have not conquered by any stretch of the imagination that disease or class of diseases. Why is that? Well, we really don't know enough. And it remains an open question if we will ever know enough to be able to, quote-unquote, cure cancer. And the same may well be true for Alzheimer's. When you're talking about the degenerative diseases of aging, especially, it's very difficult to know, you know, if we're ever going to have a cure. Perhaps we can, you know, do something, you know, we can slow them or something like that. But again, has the basic research been done? Do we know enough? Has the basic science shown scientists and the drug industry a way that will really be productive in treating that disease? And what we see in many cases, no. So that's really, in my view, where innovation begins and where the science has to evolve before you can have a significant medical breakthrough. And that's why the whole concept of pouring more and more money into the drug industry as a way of getting medical innovation sort of turns the process upside down.
I've got another listener waiting to talk with us, and I want to get to that caller pretty quickly. But before we go there, to follow up on this line to follow up on the caller's question in Champaign and what you just told us, maybe you would tell us a little something about a man by the name of Eugene Goldwasser, a protein nicknamed EPO, and how his research became a hugely successful therapy, but then, again, this hugely successful therapy is affecting further research.
Right.
It's a great story.
Yeah, it is. Dr. Goldwasser, who recently retired from the University of Chicago, spent more than 20 years of his life searching for a single protein. It was a search that began in the middle 1950s and didn't reach the conclusion until the late 1970s. And erythropoietin, which is a single protein that is produced by the kidneys, circulates in the blood, and its significance is that it signals the bone marrow to produce more red blood cells. This is a routine occurrence in our body. We are always exhausting our red blood cells as they do their job. They're excreted, and we produce new ones so that our blood, we remain healthy, non-anemic people. And certain people, this process goes wrong. An obvious class of patients for whom this goes wrong is dialysis patients or people whose kidneys have failed. Since the EPO is produced in the kidneys, if your kidneys have failed, you don't produce it. So you need, if you go on dialysis and before there was EPO, artificial EPO, you would get blood transfusions. And, of course, that was enormously costly and limited the number of people who could do it, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Dr. Goldwasser, in the middle 1950s, it actually began as a Defense Department program to look for a cure for radiation sickness. This was during the Cold War. Everybody had speculated that there was some protein in the blood that signaled red blood cell production, and that if we could find it and produce it, sort of like insulin, you know, in animals perhaps, and give it to people, that we'd cure disease with it, anemia with it. But nobody had ever found the original protein. It was really, it was not after it did its job, it disappeared. And so Goldwasser, thinking it would take him about 3 months, set out to do it. Long story short, 20 years later, he finally had got enough of it in a small vial. He had the world's sole supply of EPO. And once he had it, he never patented it. He never did any of the things that so many scientists do today. He just looked around for a company to work with who could make it using what was then the brand new technology of recombinant engineering. Well, in order to recombinantly make it, this is genetic engineering, what you needed to do is find the gene that expressed EPO, erythropoietin. And at that point, gene hunting, while a new science, and was kind of time-intensive, if not labor-intensive, meaning like, you know, a group of three or four scientists working for about a year or two could find a gene in those days. Today it takes about 2 days. But back then, it might take a couple of years for a small team to do it. But without the protein, you would never find it. So, because it would marry up to the gene that you were looking for. And so Goldwasser had the sole supply. Again, making that part of the long story short, he chose what was then called Applied Molecular Genetics, later became Amgen. And as a result, they were the ones that found the gene. There was another group that had to repeat Goldwasser's isolation of pure erythropoietin. And as a result, they did it, and they lost the race to the patent house by about the amount of time it took them to repeat Goldwasser's final experiment in terms of isolating erythropoietin. But he took his supply to Amgen, and so Amgen found the gene, made it recombinantly, and then got artificial erythropoietin onto the market, basically within about 4 or 5 years of him starting to work with them. And that drug today, sold as Epogen by Amgen, is the best-selling biotech drug in the world. And if you take its various permutations, it's the number one or two or best-selling drug in the world with $5 or $6 billion a year in sales. I estimate it cost maybe $100 million in the 1980s to develop it. And virtually, you know, all of that money is money that Amgen gets and uses for its own R&D labs and profit. It's, you know, $100 invested in Amgen in the early 1980s would be worth $1.5 million today. And it's the largest, the most profitable biotech company in the world. And they recently finally came out with what they consider to be a major new advance on Epogen, which is their artificial version of erythropoietin, and it's called Aranesp. And what they did was that they hooked a few extra molecules onto it so that it would stay in the blood longer. And this they call a major advance. I could go into what the economics of why they did it and all of that, but the point is that they've not been very productive as a research and development enterprise. And without Eugene Goldwasser's pioneering work, really a lifetime of work, and a man who nobody knows, and a man who never received a dime of royalties from his invention, there would be no artificial erythropoietin today.
And because this drug has been so successful, and it's a wonderful thing, but Eugene Goldwasser, I imagine if he was still in the lab, he would be continuing to work on kidney disease. And one of the things you point out in this chapter is that because this therapy has been so successful, we've put aside research to find a way to repair damaged kidneys.
Yeah, actually, Dr. Goldwasser, he's retired now, but he's still quite alive and quite active and still lives in Chicago and spends his, you know, summers on the shores of Lake Michigan. He was still scrambling for NIH grants at the end of his career to keep his lab going in order to figure out a way to see if we couldn't repair damaged kidney cells so that they would begin remaking erythropoietin. He thought he had some thoughts and some leads on that. I mean, this was his area of his research his whole life. It was we're talking about a man in his late 70s now. Perhaps he might even be 80 years old at this point. Forgive me, I've lost track of his age. But, his dedication was to the science that he worked on and to the people that it might help. And I think that that's another of the themes that came through in all the stories that I researched for my book, which is that when you have significant medical innovation, when you really trace back the story of something that is really important to medicine, what you always find behind that story is the dedication of an individual scientist, motivated not by money, although sometimes it plays a role, not by the idea of winning the Nobel Prize, although probably is in the back of a lot of their minds too, but really by, solving a scientific problem and helping patients. Very often you really see doctors who see patients in the clinics who are also researchers going back and trying to figure out what they can do to help the patients that they're seeing on a daily basis. And that seems to be the real, if you're looking for any single factor that I would hold up based on my research, say what is behind medical innovation, it is that sense of dedication and that sense of social purpose that I would say is the real number one factor.
Now let's talk with this caller who's been patiently waiting for us. I hope that he or she is still there. In Paris, Illinois, on the toll-free line, line 4, are you there? No, okay. My apologies. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Merrill Guzner. He's the author of The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. For this book, you interviewed a couple of hundred people, scientists, doctors, executives, patient advocates, patients. What are their frustrations with the status quo? Is there a way to put that into a nutshell?
Well, yes. I don't know about nutshell, but it depends on who you talk to. If you're talking about patient advocates, it's an interesting group because they are the lobby, if you will, for more research funding in this country. And at the very same time, they tend to be a group that gets extremely upset when the high price of drugs gets announced. And so it's very difficult when you get very close to the science of a particular disease and how it's developing and if you're dispassionate about it, it's hard, and then you look at some of these patient advocate groups, you realize that, they just are really, justifiably saying, we want more research, we want a cure, we want it now. They're very often people who either suffer from disease or their family members suffer from the disease. They're quite emotional, and it's understandable. But, one of the lessons of science is that, sometimes you just don't know, and the breakthrough isn't there, and the insight isn't there. And you can pour money into the most paths that you think will be most productive, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not like a slot machine. If you just pull it enough times, there's something's going to come out the bottom. You just can't know when or where innovation is going to come from. And that's not to say that you can't have directed research campaigns. And my book goes into some of those, AIDS being the mm-hmm. most notable success story in that regard. But it doesn't guarantee success, cancer being the most notable lack of success story, I suppose we could say. If the scientists themselves, I think, have a fairly good understanding of this process. Where that kind of breaks down is the ones who use their NIH-funded research to go into the private marketplace to try to take their idea and commercialize it. Now, this is encouraged by our laws. We have the Bayh-Dole Act, which says something that's funded with federal money can be owned by you and your institution if you patent it, and then you can commercialize it. And you have any number of scientists around the country that have gone out and started their own biotech companies, small boutique pharmaceutical companies, in order to develop therapies that they began on their federal nickel. You know, that the original invention came from research that they did with federal funding. Now, we encourage this in the name of spurring both innovation and spurring economic activity. One of the problems with this, though, is that scientists who are pursuing their own narrow path and now have a self-interest in it can lose sight of that, I'm going to do whatever it takes to solve the disease. That gradually gets replaced with a vision that says, I'm going to need to do, and in fact, when they go out and get venture capital and private capital market money in order to develop their invention, it now is, I'm going to do what it takes to develop my invention. And that's not a disease focus. That can lose you that critical dedication to solving the disease. You think my answer is the correct answer, but science says that's not necessarily true. Your answer is maybe one of five or six good ideas out there on how to best approach this problem. So the technology commercialization process and the scientists who follow that route into biotech companies, it's not that I'm saying they shouldn't do it, but they may actually be, and most biotech companies, as anybody who follows this sector in the stock market knows, are in blind alleys. They are pursuing non-productive approaches. And that's why at the governmental level or some national level, you need a kind of portfolio of people like that pursuing every possible approach that looks like it might be productive. Capital markets can contribute to that. The government can contribute to that. Nonprofits can contribute to that. But I think that what you will find in the end is that the dedicated scientist who has his eye on the ball of patient care and what's really happening to patients is the most likely to come up with innovation. And we could talk about some of the other constituencies, but those are two of the ones that I think are critical in thinking about the folks that I talk to and doing my research.
Yeah. Time is almost up here, and we've got one more caller waiting to talk with us, so let's take one last call this afternoon on a cell phone on the toll-free line, line 4. Hi.
Hello. I have a comment and then a question. My comment is, I am English, and I've been in this country for 40 years, but when I left England, the National Health Service in England had been in effect since I was about six. And frankly, most people in England feel that the National Health Service is a genuine asset to them, especially in older age. I think it is to this country's everlasting shame that there is no health care for people who cannot afford to provide it for themselves. And I don't mean people who are so poor that they should be on Medicaid. I mean people who literally go broke because one member of their family develops a disease. But my question is on the subject of diabetes. Do you think that diabetes is one of the this is type 2 diabetes, is one of the diseases which is an aging population's problem that may never be resolved because they will never understand the issues involved?
Well, I must say I am not a diabetes expert, and so I don't feel really qualified to answer your question. I will, though, make one observation, which is that the epidemic that we're having in diabetes that is related to the epidemic that we're having in obesity in this country is a serious problem and does get to some of the larger questions revolving around healthcare research and development expenditures. We spend an awful lot of money looking for various drug interventions for people when they get sick and after they've gotten sick. And we spend precious little research and development money in how to intervene in ways so that people don't get sick. And that is a form of medical research and development that is seriously underfunded in this country. What are the habits and how can you intervene in those habits that are causing the obesity epidemic in this country? That's a subject worthy of research, and it's a way of curing a lot of diabetes before it happens. And so, I see this in a lot of areas of research, and I will take it back even to the one we just spoke about, which was erythropoietin, which, after all, people who go on dialysis in this country, a good percentage of them, 30-40%, are there because of diabetes. In other words, the kidneys are, it's a bundle of small blood capillaries, and when you get diabetes, the kidneys can fail, and so you end up on dialysis. It's called the end-stage renal disease program, and the federal government spends over $20 billion a year treating those folks. Well, when there's a huge argument now that artificial erythropoietin, which stimulates red blood cell production and has to be used in dialysis, or else these people would need blood transfusions. So this is where Amgen gets a lot of its money, is through the Medicare program for people on dialysis. And the Amgen spends a lot of its research money trying to prove that higher red blood cell counts, which of course would require higher use of their drug, would be a good thing for these patients. And, you know, I went to dialysis clinics, and you looked at the people who were in there, people who were overweight, people who had hypertension and all kinds of, some of them HIV positive, all kinds of underlying diseases which led to the failure of their kidneys. And you quickly realized that whether or not somebody was 90% of normal in a red blood cell count or 100% of normal, and the amount of energy difference they had, had no medical relevance for these people at all. Better that the extra money, which could be $1 billion a year in federal expenditures, would be used to go out into the community where people had untreated diabetes or people had untreated hypertension, and in a public health kind of way, intervene in their lives in some way, getting them to treat their hypertension, getting them to diet or at least deal with the fact that they were on the road to kidney failure and were going to end up in a dialysis clinic. If you could have public health nurses running around and identifying who these people were before they end up on dialysis, that it would be a much better expenditure of money than spending more and more money on a drug to raise their red blood cell count towards normal, because after all, aren't these people just like you and I, and shouldn't they be normal, which is the argument that Amgen makes. So I know he asked about diabetes, yeah. But the question becomes, really, you know, is all the money that we're spending on drugs in the name of innovation really being spent wisely? And I think there are so many examples like the one I just gave where the answer really is no.
We have to leave it there. We've used up the time. Meryl Guzner, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure to be with you, Celeste.
Meryl is the author of The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs. The book is published by the University of California Press. 6 minutes before 2 o'clock, standing by with prices from the Board of Trade, Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste, from the Chicago Board of Trade today. And very interesting day in the trade after what was viewed initially as a pretty bullish report from USDA and the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Reports, one that lowered ending stocks to 115 million bushel, down from 125, which most traders thought would not happen. One that showed 3.5 million metric tons less beans in Brazil at 56 million metric tons rather than 59.5 million metric tons. The market opened higher in the bean pit, and it promptly moved lower. It finished down 28 cents for the day, and that continues some losses in the beans. By the way, that nearby May contract for the week from last week to this week, 57.5 cents lower. We'll talk with Jerry Bangy this afternoon during the closing market report about that. Bangy is the chairperson of the World Agricultural Outlook Board. We talked to him a little bit earlier in the day, and we'll also talk to Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services out of Bloomington Normal, Illinois. So let's start in the wheat pit for the settlement prices for this afternoon. The May wheat, 418, the high to low at 408, a settlement price there at 414. and 1/2, down a half cent. July futures 425, the high. Low at 416, settlement price at 424, down a half. In September's 430, the high, the low at 421, settlement price 427 3/4. It was a quarter lower for the day. December wheat 437, the high, the low at 427 1/2, and a settlement price there at 435 3/4, up a half cent. The March futures 440, the high, low at 431 1/2, and a settlement there at 440. It finished a penny and a half higher. Not much in the reports on the wheat today. May futures in the corn pit were higher for the day, but not nearly as high as many thought they might trade, given this morning's reports. Mostly that's in significant losses in the beans weighing on the pit and the corn. 335 1/4, the high, the low at 329. Settlement price up a half for the day at 330 1/2. July futures 341 1/2, and the high side, the low at 335 3/4. A settlement at 337 3/4, up a quarter. September corn now, 341, the high, the low at 336. They settled 337 1/4, up 3/4. And December futures unchanged on the day, 341 1/2, the high, low at 335. Settled there, 336 1/2, unchanged in that December contract. The March futures, 342, the high, the low at 337. Settled 339, up 3/4. In May soybeans, or rather May corn, 344 1/2, the high, the low at 339 1/2. A settlement price at 341 1/2. They were up one for the day. July futures of 05, 342, the high, the low at 338 1/2, settled 341 1/2. They finished one higher. In December corn, 288 1/2, the high, the low at 285 1/2, settled 287, up 2 3/4. May oats, 179 1/2, the high, the low at 173 3/4, settled 176, and they were unchanged on the day. From the soy complex, nearby May futures, $10.30, the high, the low at 986. Settled just two above that at 988, down 28 cents on the day. July beans, 1029, the high, the low at 986. Settlement at 989, they were down 29 for the week. Remember, this is the last trading day of the week. August futures in the beans, 984, the high, the low at 947 1/2. A settlement price, 951, down 20 1/2. In September soybeans, 869, the high, the low at 840. Settled 842, they were down 17. September's, 794 1/2, the high, the low at 772 1/2. A settlement price at 778. 8 1/2, down 7 1/2, and January soybeans 795 1/2, the high, low at 775, settled 779, down 8 1/2. March contract 785, the high, the low at 768, settled 774. They were down a nickel on the day. May bean meal at 327.50, high, low at 314, settled 316.80, down 770. And the May bean oil 32.92, the high, the low at 31.85, settled 31.88. They were down 79. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Merck.
April feeder cattle 91.37 1/2, the high 90.55, the low 91.22 1/2, the settlement that up 67 1/2. May 87.80, the high 86.70, the low 87.40, the settlement that up 60. August 88.65, the high 87.40, the low 88.40, the settlement that up 82 1/2. April live cattle 82.22 1/2, the high 81.55, the low 81.92 1/2, the settlement that up 45. June 76.90, the high 76 even, the low 76.67 1/2, the settlement that up 60. August 76.10, the high 75.12 1/2, the low 75.90, the settlement that up 42 1/2. October 77.50, the high, the low 76.70, the settlement 77.27 1/2, that up 30. April lean hog 63.40, the high 62.45, the low 63.07 1/2, the settlement that up 75. May